So, last year, many of you were here, and we opened, we spent a few days here working with a Vajrayana method creation practice, creation-based practice, in the context of Avalokiteshvara, Chenrezig, this tanka or painting that John so kindly brought for us, the embodiment of awakened compassion. And a few people from that retreat, this practice really clicked with them, and they've made that part of their practice. And that's been a significant method of opening and deepening their practice. And that's how I left it. It was a personal choice whether to use that practice or not. Now, in this retreat, my intention is to introduce you to three key principles of Vajrayana. That's the title of the retreat: Guru, Deity, and Protector. And there are practices associated with each of these categories, I suppose. And they're, the practices serve specific intentions. And as I've made clear in other practices, in other contexts, very important to understand the intention of a practice. So the structure for the next few days is, tomorrow is going to be a kind of general introduction. And then on Friday, it'll be about Guru. On Saturday, about Deity, or Yidam, as some of you may know it. And Sunday, about Protector. Now, some of you have been exposed or trained in these practices of these genres previously. You may find that some of the perspectives that I'm going to offer challenge, or maybe even contradict, some of the conceptions you already have. And that should make an interesting time for both of us. Others, you may have just heard about this stuff and have various kinds of ideas. And for many of you who've studied with me, you haven't been exposed to much of this stuff. And so you'll find it, you may find it a bit strange. It's a very different way of thinking. And it's quite possible that it will bring up the usual discomforts and questions and hesitations and turmoil. So, my suggestion is that you don't try to understand this at this point. Don't try to figure it out. If we use a analogy of eating, I just have a nice memory of Rinpoche when he first came to Bhutan. They had never encountered oranges, and when they got to Bhutan, given oranges, what do you do with this? You know. And it's this way with certain tropical fruits, you know, you don't know how to eat. And there's very interesting, you know, completion of the story. Because this is a big thing. You know, I remember Rinpoche telling me, you know, we didn't know what to do with these. And it's only when somebody showed us, you know, peel it and then read what's inside. Oh, okay. Maybe this is okay to read after all. Years and years later, I guess it'd be sometime in the 1980s. So this is like 25, maybe 30 years later. This meeting between Sun Sinim and Kala Rinpoche was set up in Boston, where these two masters of their respective traditions were going to talk. Dharma debate, you know, something like this. And Sun Sinim whips out an orange and says, "What is this?" And the whole thing just broke down terribly, because after about 10 minutes of discussion between Rinpoche and his translator, the translator turned to Rinpoche, turned to Sun Sinim in the audience and said, "Rinpoche is very confused. Don't they know what, doesn't he know what an orange is?" So, rather than trying to understand, I mean, if I give you an orange and you've never seen an orange before, well, what is understanding an orange? Well, okay, this is orange. Okay, I wonder if this is this where the color comes from, or was this called an orange because the color came from, you know, they get into this kind of thing, start thinking about it, you know, and what does it mean to understand an orange? I mean, do you have to understand the vine and the sections and things like that? I mean, that's not what understanding an orange means. It means feeling it, needing it. That's understanding an orange. So, over the next few days, even though there may be a lot of ideas kicked up, don't worry about understanding them. What I want you to do is to make an effort in the practice of just experiencing this. You know, tasting it. Getting the flavor. What does it feel like? So, keep an open mind. To the extent that you can, just do the practices. See how it works or doesn't work. And that's what I want you to bring up in the interviews and in our discussions together here. Now, Vajrayana in some ways it's a very special path. In other ways, there's nothing that much special about it. And in still other ways, it's just kind of weird. I want to say a bit about all three of those. Spiritual traditions, when they're healthy and alive, are not static. They change. They evolve. They develop. And experience is added on to experience. In martial arts, for instance, people say, well, these are the really ancient Chinese martial arts. Well, the really ancient ones aren't actually as good as the stuff that's actually evolved. Because somebody came up, now this is a good move, but then somebody developed a counter to it. So the original guy, or maybe his son or something like that, studied this and worked out a more refined move, which took into account that counter. So there's constant evolution. And then there are easier ways of doing things, and easier ways of training, and more effective ways. So it's not necessarily the case. In fact, it's actually relatively rarely the case that the old, ancient way is necessarily the best. And there was in these things, there's the discovery, and really quite extraordinary individuals who discovered some of these principles. And they must have been amazing people, whether they're whatever discipline, talk about martial arts, talk about spiritual practice, talk about a lot of other disciplines. But there's a whole process of refinement and evolution that takes place. And in the context of Buddhism, there's this process of evolution is very, very evident. We start off with the original teachings, Four Noble Truths, Three Marks of Existence. And as people acquired more and more experience with this, found different ways of formulating, different ways of practicing. And so you get up to around the beginning of the Common Era. Nagarjuna is a key figure here, where he takes this idea of mindful attention and begins to apply it to every aspect of experience very deeply. And one of the things that evolved out of that was the whole notion of emptiness. And a tradition that became known as the transmission or the lineage of the profound view. Meanwhile, other people thought, okay, yeah, we can sit here in the forest and in the jungle and practice this stuff and get really, really present. It gets a little tricky when you're talking with people. Particularly, and they would have lay disciples, and they would say, I got this big trade deal going down, and it's really difficult to stay present in the middle of these negotiations. I'm trying to sort out some problems in my kingdom here. How do I do this? And so you had another whole system that developed. How do you actually live in activity? Do this here and here and here and all these different activities. And that gave rise to another whole tradition called the tradition of pervasive action. Or great action. And these became two principal Mahayana traditions, because they were taking things to a new level. Now, somewhere along the line, mainly because as things get developed, but what seems to happen in spiritual traditions is that the ideal of enlightenment or awakening, or in other religious traditions, God or Allah or what have you. More and more stuff is heaped on them, more and more projection. So wonderful and so good and so pure. Now all of that stuff is like, really is kind of an appreciation of how profound and how significant it is. But the effect is to make it more and more remote, more and more distant from actual human experience. So what you have then is a whole bunch of efforts to cut through that projection. It's like right here, right now. So you get another whole process of evolution, is things like ordinary mind. You know. What is enlightenment? Ordinary knowing. Huh? I mean, I thought it was something wonderful. Is that? Or you get really weird expressions like the fourth time. What's that? Original pure. You know, there are all these things that come up. But as this continues, we have this tendency, it's more and more remote, and so the actual possibility of being awake is relegated like three kalpas of unreckonable length. That's how long it takes. This is how long it took Buddha to become the individual who became Buddha, to become Buddha. That's a long time. Mm-hmm. No, and don't forget that the definition of one of these kalpas of irreconable length is, imagine you had a pile of sesame seeds which is 100 miles long and 100 miles high or something like that. And every century, a bird comes and takes one seed. When that pile is finished, that's one kalpa. This is a long time. So, you had this whole movement, okay, how can we do this faster? And that's where you had a whole another set of methods come in. And, we're bigger, we're meaner, we're faster, we're the best. And this is all the kind of propaganda that comes up. Basically, what you have in Vajrayana is something really very, very ordinary. Ways of working very directly with how the mind, and actually the mind and body, function. Now, it doesn't look like that from the outside. On the one hand, you have this whole business about devotion to the guru, which seems like a whole big deal. And on the second thing, you have complex visualizations and practices based on yidams or deities, elaborate visualizations, and symbology, and so forth. And then you have these very disturbing, in a certain sense, practices of protectors. What are they? Everybody wants to know, what is a protector? And one of the things that I hope we can do over this, these days we have together, is to understand how these are working with very, very basic functions of the mind and opening ways to knowing that. And basically, as many of you will recall from the work we did with Chen Ruizi last year, I mean, it's actually very, very direct. Why the Vajrayana is regarded as a very direct method. It uses the symbology as a way of talking about these things, but they're working very directly with what we are, how we are. So that's one sense, it's actually very ordinary. It's also weird. Now, the original meaning for weird in Old English is to transform.
What is it?
To transform.
To transform.
Yeah. So a weirding, Druid word, it was transforming things, changing things. And there's just a vestige of that meaning left. And so, so all aspects of Vajrayana are aimed at transforming how you experience things. Now, historically, and I'm speaking historically here in an anthropological sense, not in terms of ordinary history. There are two methods of affecting transformation. One was sorcery, which transformed the phenomenal world or the experience of the phenomenal world. And second was internal, things like yoga, qigong, and so forth, which transformed energies in the body. We also have ways which go very, very far back in history of relating to the world when the world was such a strange and unpredictable place for relatively early humans that you just had to be prepared to do anything at any time if you were going to live. So, you might say the dark forces and how do you work with the dark forces in the world and in yourself. Well, those three things. Transforming experience, transforming energies in the body, working with the dark forces, all of that, that's the basis, or that's the material from where creation phase, completion phase, and protector stuff comes from. Now, living in a postmodern society as we do, we're very, very far removed from that, which is why when we come in connection with this stuff, it's a bit weird, in both senses. It's strange, it's unfamiliar. And yet, for many people, it speaks to some deep roots inside. Now, because of the methodologies, or to put it a different way, In another sense, Baudrillard is the maturation of practice. We find that unless there are problems put in, or impediments put in place, as there very, very often are by certain philosophical perspectives, you'll find that when a person practices, the first thing they focus on is attention, just coming into attention. And that's really what the earlier traditions of Buddhism were about, Theravada and so forth. But when you develop a certain level of attention, the way you experience things begins to shift. And it shifts in two ways. One is because you understand the process of suffering as it arises in you very, very clearly. You realize it's exactly the same in everybody else. So compassion naturally arises. And many teachers who are deeply practiced, they can make you, they can really express the feeling of greed or pride or anything, all of these negative things very clearly. Why? Because through their practice, they know them intimately. You know, one of my students, when he first introduced to the six realms, said, you know, yeah, I can relate to, I can relate to the Titan realm and the Hell realm. Yeah, it's got a lot of anger and competitive. Yeah, I don't think I had much to do with the others. I said, okay. 6-8 months later, yeah, I can see I got some traitor stuff in me too. Hungry ghost. I'm a bit of animal. That's about it. Couple of years later, they're all there, aren't they? Yeah. Because they're all there. They're states that we move into. And so, the deeper we move into our own experience, the more intimate our knowledge of the reactive emotions, patience, the process of karma, how actions actually evolve into experience results, the wonderful dynamics of fixation on the self-image. We truly extraordinary. And the more intimately we know those in ourselves, the more clearly we see them in others. Because it's no different. You know, the form and content may be different, but the process is exactly the same. And so when we see somebody getting upset about something and getting upset at us, it doesn't trigger anger because we know what's going on. So we have this compassion arising. At the same time, as our capacity to an attention develops, we find ourselves spending more and more time looking at absolutely nothing. And through this process, we begin to appreciate that there really is nothing there. And it's okay. In fact, there being nothing there is what makes freedom possible. Which, when you first present that idea to the people, they go, huh? And it just doesn't make any sense at all. But through this experience, maturation of experience, we begin to see that. Now, the consequence of that, of looking at nothing, is that space opens up. And I remember many years ago talking to Jack Kornfield, he said, what would you say the principal difference is between Theravadan and Mahayana? And I didn't have a lot of acquaintance with Theravadan at that stage. Somewhat more now. But, well, as far as I can tell, I have the whole notion of space. You know, emptiness is very much about space, of course. And Jack said, that's very interesting. Ajahn Chah was the only one of my teachers who ever talked about space. And if you read Ajahn Chah's stuff, it's virtually identical to a Tibetan teacher talking about Mahamudra. But there's a maturation there. Now, so there you have emptiness and compassion, which is the natural evolution of mindfulness. But now you have another step. There's this whole phenomenal world, this world of experience. So the next step is, of evolution, is actually living the ethic of compassion and emptiness in everything that you do. And becoming no one in the process. And so the notion of withdrawing from the world to become something drops away completely. And it's replaced by a sense of doing the practice, doing whatever you do in life. And that finds expression, and I didn't bring this with me, I only thought of it as I was talking here, to the body of a group of individuals, who, the 84 Mahasiddhas, who were totally strange people. Thieves, cobblers, arrowsmiths, which is equivalent to being an arms manufacturer, you understand? Gun maker, in today's parlance. Kings, courtesans, everybody, and that was part of the trip here. They practiced. doing whatever their life wants. One of them is a glutton. He had an eating disorder, okay? Put this into modern parlance. The instruction that he was given. I really wish I brought this with me now. It would have been useful. Johnny, do they still have the library here, don't they? Mm-hmm. Seems to have 84 Mahasiddhas in it. They may have. The 84 Mahasiddhas. Anyway, the instruction that he was given in his for his meditation practice. Eat the world. That was his practice. So whenever he sat down to meditate, he just ate. And just managed chomping through the world. Now, you have to understand practice like this. You don't get to say, I've had enough. Yeah. There isn't any of that choice. And so he ate the world. Of course, eventually there wasn't any world left. And then he woke up. Sounds very simple, doesn't it? It's not as easy as it sounds. So, Vajrayana represents a maturation of practice. It represents a maturation in the student, a maturation in the teacher, a maturation in the relationship between the two. And I'm going to talk more about that day after tomorrow. But this is very important. Vajrayana isn't for everybody. Now, when Rinpoche taught about this, he'd say, Hinayana, it's a Volkswagen. Mahayana, it's an ocean liner. Vajrayana, it's a rocket ship. Now when you hear this, everybody wants to take the rocket ship, right? Yeah, that's tensing. Oh, fast, zippy, sexy. Yeah, a whole bit. One forgets that the point of the exercise is to go from A to B. Volkswagen could do the job just very nicely. Because of the nature of Vajrayana, and I think this is true of any form of spiritual practice, particularly Trinity, there is, for each of you, going to be a decision point. Not necessarily this weekend. This is very much introduction. Though I hope we can go fairly deep. But there's going to be a decision point. Is this a path or method that I want to use? And there's a lot that goes into that. And the point of our time together is to get a feeling for all of that. So you actually know what it is rather than having to stand on the outside and say, do I want to do this? But as with most spiritual practices, traditions or meanings. Once you decide, there isn't really any going back.